In the final segment of a three-part interview, Louisa Martinez and Dr. Mitch Green return to the way economists frame the economic problem, that is, understanding the dynamics of a social provisioning process. They discuss what the heterodox school of economics has to say about the possibility for a non-capitalist economy.
Hey, everybody. Mi nombre es Louisa Martinez, and welcome to the third and last part of my interview with heterodox economist Dr. Mitch Green. Mitch is a PhD economist living in Portland, Oregon. He teaches classes at Portland Community College. He also researches and works on issues related to energy economics as a research scholar for the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He's a first-generation college student, anti-imperialist army veteran, lover of dogs, and sits on the board of Clowns Without Borders as their economic advisor / elected hospital clown representative. Hey, Mitch. Thanks for talking to me.
Glad to be here again. Always a pleasure to find out what my hobbies are.
I want to just take the time to summarize the two visions of the economy that we've been talking about. So mainstream view is that the economy is fundamentally scarce. People are fundamentally self-interested. That markets, free market, right, is necessary to allocate those scarce resources. And that's just the best we got. Alternatively, with heterodox economics, the economy is a social provisioning process where key features are socially constructed, that we control them, and that resources are produced and not inherently scarce. And that is a much more open and discretionary view. So last time we spoke, we started to broach the subject of inflation, or more broadly, the limits of deficit spending. And, you know, we didn't really get into it. So I still don't understand why you're not worried about multi-trillion-dollar spending bills, right? So keeping in line with the idea that we could afford things like universal health care and free college and federal jobs guarantee, that, you know, these multi-trillion-dollar spending bills, why you're not worried that they could result in inflation. And the reason why is because there's really clear examples in history of countries trying to kind of print their way out of budget crises and that not working out so well. So can you kind of bring some clarity?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably the biggest point of confusion, where like there's a gap between how I've approached explaining this and kind of where people are at in terms of thinking through the main issue at hand. And so let me bring us back to that household / government finance analogy problem as a sort of point of departure, because I think that's really critical in understanding how these limits are constructed. So it's true in the United States, for the case of the United States, I'm not worried about big inflationary episodes following a spate of like multi-trillion dollar spending packages. And that's primarily because of the way that we have structured our monetary institutions. We're not on a gold standard. We are not on a fixed exchange rate with another external currency. And so when the United States spends, creates new money by deficit spending, it doesn't do so with a promise to convert to anything besides dollars. And so in a sense, it doesn't have a fixed promise that would place it in the same basket as household does, like where we have to collect dollars before we can spend.
So wait, just to recap, last time we talked about how a personal budget that you can't project kind of the constraints that we all have as individuals when it comes to a household budget, right? We go to work, we get a paycheck, we use that to spend bills. That's not the way that the federal treasury works, because we only have one experience, you said, of something that are two different experiences. We only have the experience of a currency user, and that's distinct. That's very, very different from a currency creator. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Right. And so when I'm talking about the possibilities for federal spending, I'm going from the perspective of the currency issuer, right? The federal government is the currency issuer. So it can always afford anything for sale in dollars. What really matters, though, is what is the effect of that spending on the economy? And will it create bottlenecks, shortages, or will it expand productive capacity? Let's suppose we went out and did a big spending bill that kind of massively increased public housing, free at the point of service, free at the point of housing, you know, Medicare for all, student loan forgiveness, a Green New Deal, forgiveness of international debts, and just a huge grab bag of a big, you know, progressive or quasi-socialist policy objectives, that would end up relaxing the constraints on many of the sort of things that sort of everyday people have as an experience in their household budget. And so you don't get squeezed when you create resources in that regard, right? And you sort of, you send a signal to the rest of the economy that says we are going to have a long period of growth. And so you see investment in more productive capacity, and you sort of increase your ability to generate resources. Okay, but it's not always the case that deficit spending does that. It could also end up being in a situation that shoots you in the foot, right? And that's what I was trying to get towards last time when we talked about how it's important to think about specific supply chains and whether or not they have enough slack in them or the capacity to sort of absorb big changes in demand. And so last time I had said, look, we are currently experiencing little sort of episodic or pointed high price events or shortages, like in lumber or trying to go buy a new car. It's because we left to the private sector the problem of infrastructure provisioning for a really long time. And so they didn't build enough capacity to supply us with the stuff we need today. But that again is, that's not a forever thing. That can always be changed if we change policy. And money can be used to serve that goal. So I want to take us to the experience of some of these headline hyperinflationary moments in history where folks go to immediately when I talk about deficit spending as being sort of like, quote unquote, printing money or engendering this idea that, you know, the sky's the limit on anything that we can do, because we kind of tend to think, well, actually, there have been moments where that wasn't the case, and it caused folks to have to go out with wheelbarrows of cash to sort of go down the street and buy a loaf of bread. I mean, clearly you're lying to me, Mitch. And I want to point out that those were very different experiences and institutional arrangements than what the United States currently has. In Weimar Germany, where you had hyperinflation, that was a situation where post-Treaty of Versailles, you had significant reparations on Germany and their ability to produce stuff. And they had significant debts in an external currency because the Allied victors placed these kind of onerous conditions on them that they could not meet, even under the best of conditions. And so trying to spend your way out of that while ignoring that external constraint causes that hyperinflationary problem. You might be in a war-torn country where a famine is going on and also owe debts in an external currency. So if you try to print your way out of that, you're going to have a hyperinflation episode, right? Or finally, if you look at a country like Venezuela and you see like hyperinflation or rapid inflation going on in the Bolivar, it's important to recognize that that currency is on a pegged fixed exchange relationship, even if it gets adjusted, with dollars. And it's a desire to earn petrodollars in order to generate revenues from international trade. And that's set against a context where there's significant sanctions and constraints on the
ability.
Hold on,
sorry. Every time I say sanctions, my friends in Venezuela insist I use the term unilateral coercive measures, because okay. Sanction implies that more than one country wants to do them. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I felt pressure to interrupt you. I just wanted to talk more.
That's fair.
I wanted to reflect it in the notes.
Yeah. I'm not tied to any language here. So the substantive point here is that sometimes a specific nation state or country is under the thumb of a set of coercive relationships that can undermine their ability to use monetary relationships or relations to steward resources. Okay, you can't ignore these power dynamics. And so in those cases, you want to think about those experiences as if they're users of a currency, not issuers of a currency. And so inflation is a really tricky concept. I think most of us think about inflation as if you double the money supply, then you've halved the purchasing power of your currency in proportion, Right. And that's just not how it works. That's a kind of, it's a naive story about how it works. In the real world, inflation is the results of a very complicated set of responses in the economy to changes in prices and costs. And prices are administered by firms, corporations, or in some cases, governments. And sometimes they pass on costs and higher prices. Sometimes they absorb them. But you want to think about inflation as being the abdication or the relaxation or the failure to regulate certain industrial aspects of your society, rather than simply an automatic response to the fiscal authorities going out and trying to spend.
And you're saying that the reason why we wouldn't have necessarily as that type of problem in the United States is because the U.S. is a sovereign country. I mean, the United States is true sovereignty.
Yeah, it's on many, across many different measures, but I'm speaking most specifically in terms of its currency. So we simply do not, we're not at the behest of any other place in the world as to how we regard our dollar. So it's just completely up to the Treasury.
So just, you know, if you had to give a last thought in terms of the people listening, and if there's one idea that they should, that you might encourage them to purge from their minds in terms of preconceived notions about how the economy works, what would you urge them?
Yeah, I would like to remind folks that we live inside of capitalism. We live inside of a market society. And sometimes it can be really hard to see outside of the structures and institutions that make up that society. And so there's an impulse to project upon all of history and time the things that seem commonplace today as if they are natural phenomena. And so going back to this distinction between how heterodox economists view what I call the social provisioning process versus the way, say, a neoclassical or mainstream economist views economics as just being about allocation of scarce resources in markets, is that we have a much bigger problem to contend with. And there's much more possibilities open to us as human beings in how we choose to arrange the specific social practices and institutions that you know, produce our resources, engage in reproduction of our technologies and our systems of production, and then figure out how to distribute all that. These are all very much subject to social construction, mediation, and we can always devise a different system as long as we have the technology to do so. And so that's why I said in the beginning that as long as a thing is technologically possible, you can always find a way to pay for it. It's because the money thing is just, it's just a social relationship and an institution like anything else. And so we shouldn't think of that as being the limiting factor if we're thinking about production and distribution as sort of an international project of solidarity, right? We can always find ways to be in coalition with our working class comrades around the world to figure out how we share our resources and build an equitable, sustainable, and just society.
Mitch Green, economist / real hippie. So thank you. Really appreciate the time.
You don't get to call me a hippie. You can call me a lot of things, but not that.
Okay. Thanks.
Could have been anything that we wanted to be, and it's not too late to change. I'd be delighted to give it some thought. Maybe you'll agree that we're really on 2, 3, 4. We could have been anything that we want.